Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's June 8th, 2014, and welcome to episode 76 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
The RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, and collecting. I'm Steve Weirich, and I'm your host for this week. I run the Apple II History website, and based on that website, I've published a book called Sophistication and Simplicity, The Life and Times of the Apple II Computer, available at Amazon and other fine book retailers. Blatant plug. But although I know more about the Apple II than any other computer, I am interested in other vintage computer platforms, and I'm willing to give them all the credit to which they are due. Joining me here today are some fellow retro computing enthusiasts, and they also deserve the credit to which they are due. In alphabetical order, we have Paul Hagstrom. Good afternoon, Mr. Hagstrom.
Good day, all.
How are things in your part of the world? Where is your part of the world, by the way?
Well, my part of the world is usually Boston, but at the moment I'm north of the border, up in Carrington Land, in Montreal. So, yes, good day, eh?
And from the Southern Hemisphere, we have Michael Mulhern, who is podcasting from his 8-bit bunker in Sydney, Australia. Good day, Mr. Mulhern.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Queen's birthday long weekend here in Australia. God save the Queen.
Good to hear that. And to round out this table, from up Norton, Derridat, and Canada Place, we got Harrington Vanston. Good day, Mr. Vanston.
Hello, eh?
So, any interesting news anybody wants to just start off with today? Anything exciting happening in your worlds at the moment?
Paul has invaded our country.
I know. That's
right. We have to start somewhere.
The first of the large force that is being sent up one at a time.
It started with Paul.
Yeah, the Royal Canadian Mounted Police have been overwhelmed by Paul. No, the only thing I suppose that's new for me is that I'm actually have my 8-bit bunker online, did the networking yesterday afternoon, and yes, it's good to have my own little place in the house where I can play with my retro computers and have my library. So as far as I'm concerned, all is good with the world.
Nice. Here in Omaha, we've had some crazy weather this past week. We had big old storm run over the city that was dropping literally baseball-sized hail on parts just north of us. We had an entire car dealership demolished from that. About 4,500 cars all gone to the retro resellers. It was a mess.
A little bit past a hail sale.
Yeah, boy, it's like smashed windows and, you know, more than just little dented dimpled darlings. It's like smashed. There's a lot of interest apparently in people wanting to buy these partly damaged cars for at discounted prices. But still, it was a mess there.
Did you made it through okay?
Yeah, we just had lots and lots of water pouring down off the roof and through the gutters that are plugged up. So for the show today. We have start off. We're going to have news, and we're going to have eBay items to talk about, and we're going to start with a topic to throw amongst ourselves here at the roundtable, and that would be if somebody wants to, having listened to this show and other similar shows, and they said, you know, I'd like to get into that retro computing stuff. I used a computer back when. And I'd like to do it again, but I've got nothing today. What's the best way to get started with it if you want to go from ground zero? Who wants to jump in on this?
I'll start. I would say I guess I have two bits of advice. The first is I would generally suggest that if you want to get into retro computing, you should start by seeking out what you either had or always wanted to have as a kid, because there's a major nostalgia kick when you finally pick up that computer that you can never afford when you were younger, or you go back and get that one that you used to play that favorite game on. And it can be really satisfying. And so rather than getting into the hobby and the first thing you do is try to learn something brand new and maybe you don't have time for it or what have you, it's nice to sort of ease in with something a little bit familiar. And the second bit of advice I would give is it's really easy to overspend. When you first come into the hobby, you might not know whether like a given game you want to pick up or a given computer is a good price for that $20 or $200 or what have you. If you just dive in and buy the first thing you see as a buy it now on eBay, for instance, it's very likely that you could have purchased it for far less. It's kind of ridiculous the major swings between highs and lows of like what a given particular product might go for a week by week or just at the same time on eBay. So I would instead say if you're outside of America, you can save a ton by trying to find somebody in your own country, like locally, go on Craigslist, go on Kijiji, something like that, to try to find something locally you can swing by and pick up, because then you've also got another local contact for retro computing things. Look for a retro computing user group or something like that in your city. Great contacts to find things or can repair them or just might have something for a sale. And maybe use a service like CraigsWatch. There's services like that that will let you have a standing search in Craigslist. So instead of just going on right now and saying, hey, are there any Apple IIs, you can just do a search for Apple II on something like CraigsWatch, and it'll simply email you as soon as there's something local that has the term Apple II in it, and you can just sort of use that as an ongoing search buddy. So those sorts of things can ease you getting into the hobby without having to spend a ton of money.
That sounds like a useful service. I didn't know, that had not heard of CraigsWatch before.
Yeah, it used to be a paid service and a website, and then it became a piece of software, and then it became freeware. So now it's available as freeware, and there's also like a website as well you can use. So I'll stick links in the show notes to all that in case people are interested.
And I'll agree with that the getting something, you don't have trouble with the whole concept of Craigslist, because there are some shady things with that, but a lot of people do things with Craigslist that are perfectly legit. And I looked on there one time locally, and someone was willing to sell an Apple II system with a bunch of software for like, you know, $200. And this was for all kinds of stuff. This was like stuff that would, on eBay, somebody would put it up there and say, this is a $1,000 system they want to sell. So you can, and you can actually have a chance to look at it and see if that it works before you pick it up and put it in your car and take it home, instead of just getting it in the mail, you know, functioning or not.
Yeah, I think I would have to agree that it does, although when you're just starting and you don't have a whole lot of background behind you, it is very tempting to just kind of go buy stuff. You don't want to wait 3 months and see if you can get a better price. But it turns out, actually, if you wait 3 months, you will get a better price. It's almost everything. When I started in on this, I guess first, of course, myself, I was headed for the nostalgia. It wasn't that I thought, I've heard of retro computing, that sounds fun, where should I start? It was more like, oh, I remember this game or whatever. But then I cast my net so wide that it was possible to wait because you know, there's such a huge list of things that if I see it, I'll get that when it's cheap. So. But emulating first, and then waiting while you're emulating might be one way to go about this. And you know, if you can find something locally, if you happen to be in an area where there's kind of a local scene.
And I will say also, if you get something off of eBay, something you're going to have shipped to you, it doesn't hurt to actually communicate a little bit with the person who's sending it to you and make sure that they know what they're doing when they send it. I learned that when my very own first owned Apple II was an Apple IIc, and I sold it after that to get an Apple II GS, and saw one on eBay for a reasonable price not long ago. I thought, oh, well, I'll just order that. And so I did. I paid the person, and when they shipped it out with I guess they were trying to be nice. They shipped it with a can of Energy Pop wrapped up inside the box, which banged around and broke off a few of the keys. Didn't hurt the monitor, thankfully, but and then the box actually was torn by then, so one of the keys fell out and is missing. So it's like, just because they're selling on eBay doesn't know what they know what they're doing when they ship something. Ask them to wrap it all carefully and don't put a can of pop in there with it.
That's really weird.
Yes,
but
it is.
Yeah, I have mostly had good luck, but with people shipping things to me, but there it definitely, if they are somebody who doesn't have a lot of experience sending heavy, fragile stuff, then which you can tell, but it's worth looking at the feedback, even though I sort of find the feedback scores on eBay to be fairly meaningless, because it's pretty much everybody has to, it's a big insult to give anything less than perfect. So people, you know, so at least it's worth kind of reading them like you would read a recommendation letter, you know, where
right.
if it's a sort of what shade of good is this that you're reading?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, definitely with the packing, a lot of people don't really realize that when they're packing heavy items, they need to actually immobilize those items in the packing rather than just pouring in some expanded polystyrene chips or
right.
putting a few things in there. So, the other thing I can say is that after you've looked at eBay, especially what you're looking at, and you've determined a price, stick to that limit. Don't get emotionally involved. Just if you want to spend $75 on something, stick to it. You will pick it up. I must admit, I've got emotionally involved on some items and paid more than I should have. But most of the time, if you miss it this time, there will be another one that comes around, and maybe that one will be yours, because at least you've eliminated that person who bought the last one. They are out of the running, hopefully, unless they're after a sideboard of one particular model.
Right, you want to collect all the leases in the world or something.
Yes, right. I've been a little bit surprised, actually, how much it is the case that another one will come up. I mean, you know, often I will look at one and I will say, well, you know, I just have to buy this because I don't think I'll ever see one again. And then four more appear, you know, within the next month.
Especially because if the one sells, it convinces other people, hey, I'll take
that.
That's
right. Oh, I can get $500 for this. And suddenly there's half a dozen being listed and you pick it up for $50.
One of them is buyer's remorse from the guy who bought the first one.
Right. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. If you buy two in that situation, then at least you've kind of averaged out okay.
So your suggestion is people should dive in and buy multiples of the same thing.
Yeah, well, if you buy an expensive one, then buy a cheap one.
Oh, I see. If you find something local, though, you can avoid the shipping costs. And if you're getting into the hobby with the intention of purchasing old computers, they're not like modern laptops where it's 2 and 3 pounds. The old computers can be 20-pound behemoths that are very difficult to pack and very expensive to ship. If you find it locally, you just drive and pick it up. You can save significantly on that.
Yes.
Especially monitors. Mm. They are deceptively heavy. Most people are very aware of the old large screen CRT TVs that everyone's pushing out onto the footpaths for the council cleanups. When now they're replacing, putting in nice slim LCD LED TVs. But I was surprised how heavy some of those 12 and 14 inch computer monitors were. They were definitely much heavier than the standard TV of the day. Not quite sure why, but and one of those jumping around on top of the computer console, and you'll probably get a damaged monitor and plastic confetti.
Oh yes. Well, so you want to get the device, the computer, and then as far as the software to go with it, you've got the same resources, potentially Craigslist and eBay. Any hints or tips you can offer about purchasing software online?
Yeah, the first thing I'd say is get something that lets you use disk images rather than disks. So you want to get back into it. Spend the money, if you're an Apple II person, for instance, pick up a CFFA 2000, 3000, 5000, whatever the number of thousands is up to. And then the world's your oyster, and you can download everything that's ever been made and play it. That's not as fun as getting original discs, but getting original software can be very expensive. Like, it's crazy. Like, you'll pick up the computer cheap, and then you'll go and try to get yourself a boxed copy of a game, and people want $200 for it or something, just totally crazy. So if you get something that lets you use disk images, at least you get back into using it and you can see, am I actually really liking this? Do I want to spend a lot of money on it before you go and devote the money and the space to boxes and boxes of software? It's also really fun, though. Once you pick up a vintage computer, now you have a reason to start going yard sale shopping or garage sales or rummage sales or whatever people call it around the world. Because all the time people are – that's another source for getting vintage computers, but people will sell boxes of discs, and it's assorted stuff, and who knows what's on them. And that can actually be really fun. You go pick up a box of old Apple II discs, and then you sit there with 25 discs, and you go through them and see what you get. You can pick those up really cheaply at yard sales, and it can be a lot of fun to go through them.
Although I don't see as many retro computers at least in my area, yard sales, as I might find somebody's got a PC clone that they don't want, a 386, a 486 they don't want anymore. Although those are now becoming retro computers in their own right. But if you want something that's more of the late 70s, early 80s vintage, I think it's going to be a little harder to find that unless you have somebody who simply is selling, you know, grandpa's collection at an estate sale and they don't know what they've got.
I was going to say estate sales is probably where you're going to have to go these days. I don't do too much in the way of garage sales and the like around the place, but I have noticed a definite switch these days. It's computers of the 90s. If you look at it, that's what people were using and they're now getting rid of. That's what's been hanging around the house and taking up space.
Yes.
If you use like CraigsWatch, which again we'll have linked to, or Search Tempest, or those things that will search Craigslist for you, people with large collections at garage sales often advertise that they're having the garage sale. So on Tuesday, they'll put an ad on Craigslist saying, hey, this Saturday we've got a garage sale, and they'll list the topics. And if they are selling a vintage computer, even if you have it, I'll always go. Anybody who advertises they're selling Apple II or Sinclair things or what have you, because I went to four or five of those last year. People advertise them. And I show up not looking to buy the computer, but they'll always have all those other things. They'll have the box of discs, and people generally don't want those. So you swoop in early and say, no, I'll take that for $2, and it's, you know, 100 discs. I've got tons and tons of garage sale discs now that I've been going through and having a lot of fun looking at.
And frankly, if you just want discs, I mean, there certainly are going to be some of the floppy, the 5 1/4 inch floppy discs that you can't format to use on an old computer, but there's going to be a lot of them that you can.
Good point.
And you can't just go buy, well, you can just go buy a box of new discs these days, but they're expensive.
Yeah, all right. And they may well not work very well.
That's right. Well, at least if you get a box of old discs and you get half of them working and you started with no discs, then you've got something at least.
I might add in here before we move on, if you have the capacity to back up what's on that disk before you format it. That might be good, just in case someone's got some code that doesn't exist anywhere else there.
Good point. All right, shall we move on to our items of news and interest?
Let's do it.
Mr. Vanston, you have something about modern kids and retro computers. Tell us about that.
There is a YouTube channel. I think they're called the Fine Brothers, something like that. I'm not going to open YouTube while we're on recording. My computer won't like it. I'm an older one today. And they do a series of videos of modern young kids, sometimes it's teenagers, sometimes it's very young kids, reacting to technology. So they'll say, let's put the kids in front of a record player and see what they think of it. And so they've recently done a couple of episodes that I think listeners to our show would enjoy. And one of them is modern kids reacting to retro computers. And in this case, it's an Apple II. So they plop some young kids from early teens down to very young in front of an Apple II. And they say, okay, go at it. And they say, can you figure out how to turn it on? Can you figure out how to do? And they say, how do I get on the internet? They have to tell them where the on button is. The kids are obviously overreacting the way kids will on video, and like, this is crazy and the worst thing ever and what have you. But it's also kind of funny because I kept thinking of, this is in some way how people used to react to computers. You would get a computer and they'd have to get a video. How do you turn your computer on? How will you find software? And we're so used to computers now, it's easy to forget that it used to be something that was sort of alien. And kids today have progressed into a new form of technology, and everything's GUI, everything's easy to use, everything's internet connected. So it's made these retro computers just as foreign to them as they were to original buyers. So there's modern kids reacting to retro computers, the Apple II here, and also have a link to one where kids react to 1990s internet. So that one's also really fun. So they're put in front of that. Yeah.
Yeah, I watched the teens react to the internet one, and that was hilarious.
Yeah, yeah, they're both really fun to watch, so I recommend them. We'll have links to both in the show notes.
Yeah, they had one earlier in that series where they had the kids looking at a dial telephone, and trying to figure out how to use a dial telephone. And their kid's got his hand on the dial, and he's actually turning it right and left with his hand, and it's his entire hand. And he says, well, how would you send a text on this phone, he says to the kid. And he's trying to, you know, it was pretty fun.
The message is kids today are dumb. Is, I think, the major takeaway. We're becoming more and more stupid.
Yeah, it's funny. I think when I watch these, the modern kids react to a retro computers video has made the rounds a little bit in the social media of this space, and I guess I reacted a little bit less positively to it just because I sort of felt like, oh, they're insulting my computer, you know? But just because it does seem like, well, of course, you didn't give them a chance. It was all very staged to turn out the way it did in a way.
But, yeah, they don't even give them a floppy to start with, so it's not like it's got something in it where you turn it on and it'll do something. So.
And I think the reaction that kids would have had, you know, to seeing this when it was new is that, wow, this can do like sort of like interesting stuff rather than you can't even send a text with this thing.
Exactly. It's we're so jaded, you might say, by the modern technology, the stuff that is simple, that going back to something that required more effort to use is, like you say, had it been new, they would have said, whoa, this is exciting. And since it's old and doesn't do what the new stuff does, it's like, wow, how primitive is that?
And yet I would argue that if we bide our time, so let's have these same kids 25 years from now, plop them in front of an Apple II and plop them in front of basically any piece of technology from today, PlayStation 4, an Xbox, a modern computer, a game, anything, the Apple II, if the floppies are okay, will work as intended. The PlayStation 4 will say, I can't connect to the server. That's not down anymore. My DRM's not responding. Nothing
yeah.
will work anymore. You put a game in and say, no, that server's not responding. You have to update. I can't get... Nothing that the kids are using today will even be functional when they're 30 years old. So the Apple II will win in the end, I see.
Yeah, my 33 and a third LP records are still going to play 100 years from now if there's still a record player to play them on. I don't know my floppy disks would last that long.
No.
Well, Paul, you've got something you were looking up about the Sharp PC 1403.
Yeah, well, I was just sort of like looking around to see what I could talk about today, and it turned out that I came across. So there was a I think they call them demo parties. I had this up a minute ago. So the Outline 2014. This was a demo party that was in the Netherlands, and. There was a video of a Sharp PC 1403 calculator. It's a calculator on which you can program in BASIC. And the entry that they had was basically this calculator playing music. And it's really quite astonishing that it is what they managed to do. So we'll have a link to it. Probably not worth actually playing it in the podcast, but we can have a link to it, and you can be somewhat amazed at how they actually got this thing to do it. I'm not quite sure how they managed to get this thing to do it, but because it's basically a one-bit speaker. I read some of the details, and it said it was sending something out the serial port, so it might have been cheating a little bit, but it's still pretty impressive.
I love the old calculators, the scientific calculators, that would run a language, like something like this, where you could have a handheld BASIC on it. I just think that's delightful. I love those.
And especially when you take some old technology, we're talking about how old and primitive some of these things were, but taking it and finding a way to make it do something that was not really intended for it to do, and yet somebody figures out how to work around that thing, and there it does. It plays music, or gets on the internet, or whatever they do.
Let's see the kids react to this one.
Yeah, doggone it. Put those kids there.
Keep up my lawn. And,
by the way, fun. I should say, the music, I'm sorry to interrupt there, the
yeah,
music is, it's multi-voice. I mean, it's there's some speech synthesis in there. It's really just ridiculously. It's nothing like what you would expect to come out of this.
That's pretty cool.
It's crazy.
They'd probably react more to the music than actually using it as a calculator.
Yes.
I mean, I'm sure it's running at you know, the maximum assembly speed that it can. But
So Michael, what do you have now for our next topic here?
Well, I was just looking at the various things that were catching my eye, and this one from the AT&T archives on the Unix operating system. Now, my day-to-day existence is in a AIX environment, so I was sort of thinking, well, yeah, the AIX from the Unix, it's it's all pretty retro, has evolved into what we're using today for a lot of our high-end servers. And it was just interesting to see out of the AT&T archives a video on introducing Unix. And then as you fall down these rabbit holes, I then sort of continued across to the AT&T tech channel. And there is just so much interesting video snippets out there on technical items from the 80s, early 90s, moon orbit communications, television and the telephone. Even I love some of the ones which are sort of like set back in the 80s looking to the future. You know, one there is called Century 21 Calling, and it's, you know, it's set in the 80s. So like, you know, what will the 21st century be like? And it always amazes me how far off the mark they were. I'm still waiting for my atomic-powered hover car.
I'm still waiting for the apes to take over.
And I had that forgotten also, that I had forgotten that AT&T Bell Labs is where Unix got created.
Yeah, that's where Skynet started.
Which is interesting. The a lot of times those predictions they seem to be pretty much it's always at one extreme or another. It's either wow, they nailed it really, really early, or this has nothing. This bears no relation to reality.
Yeah, the science fiction stories of the 50s, the radio dramas of the 50s that played science fiction, sometimes are particularly funny to listen to about how they thought something would be working, and they just totally got it missed.
And yet we're so optimistic about we will visit the moon frequently, we will go to other planets, we will solve food shortages. Like, they thought we would do better than we did in so many categories. I feel like we've let the 50s down.
We have. We really have.
Now, we are far less sexist than they thought we would be. So we went up them there, but we sort of gave up on a lot of moon stuff.
And they didn't realize that instead of going to the moon every day, we'd be having cat videos.
Isn't that what our bandwidth is for?
That's right.
Apparently, yes.
Yes. I'll just see them introducing a new internet plan. 20 gigabytes of download, all cat videos free.
All right. I'm signing up for that one.
I'm going to live in the woods.
Right.
I am.
Well, I have a news item I wanted to share. I kind of look around on the retro computing group on Google+, and something the Microcomputer Museum put up, they had a video they have about the Control Terminal Corporation, 2200 data point terminal, something that they created in the late 60s, early 70s. They made this thing, and it looks, when you look at the pictures of it, it looks a lot like what you'd imagine an old early desktop computer look like. It's got the keyboard and the little TV monitor and stuff like that. They made it specifically, though, as a terminal. It's not itself, wasn't really computer-ish, except they did put a little memory into it. They had about 4K of RAM in there, and they did it all with discrete hardware, and then they approached Intel and asked them to create a microprocessor chip to try to do what the terminal could do. And Intel didn't want to do it at first, but later agreed to work on it, and they wanted $50,000 for the work. And at some point along the way, Computer Terminal Corporation didn't decide to follow through and pay for it, but Intel went on to do the work with that, and they made this is what developed into the Intel 8008 chip.
Nothing ever came of that.
Yes, not at all. But you see, and I just always thought, well, there's the 4004, and then they moved it to the 8008, and then the 8080, and that's how it moved from there. But apparently there was other forces at work here that encouraged Intel to make advancements in this area. So it's an interesting story looking at this and then hearing the background behind it. We'll have the link in the show notes, of course. Mr. Vanston,
mm-hmm.
Talk about your little thing here. I can't read that.
Space baby. Not space baby, but giant space baby's coming. Get everyone into the B arc. No, what I pronounce it IC3, but it's the ISEE3 Reboot Project. It's how, basically, it's about how we're speaking to a vintage computer in space.
In space.
So back in 1978, I think it was, the ISEE-3 was launched. It's the International Sun-Earth Explorer. That's the ISEE, and it was number three of those, and it went up and studied the Earth, the magnetosphere, for a while, and then in 1983, it said, you know what, let's send it off to do its last thing, and it was sent out in orbit around the Sun, basically in the same kind of orbit the Earth's on, and just did its thing. That's 36 years ago. It's been dead for a while, but it was on a trajectory that it was supposed to be rough, very soon, coming back around to Earth. So over on Rocket Hub, a group of people got together to raise... They went to NASA and said, why don't we try to talk to it? Why don't we try to do something with it? NASA's like, we don't have the money, we don't have the time. So this group got together, did crowdfunding on Rocket Hub, raised about $160,000, and said, okay, NASA, we've got the money, now we let us on. So they got access to some NASA talk to space thing. And I guess This IC3 has two radios on it, an A and a B, that technically you're supposed to be able to send stuff to and respond. So they sent a burst of, hey, how you doing, messages to B and into space, and nothing happened. So they said, uh-oh. So they tried to send stuff to A, and it responded, said, I'm doing great, going to be back to Earth soon, see you in August. And so the battery's been long dead, but it's fully functional. So these people say, well, okay, let's do something with it. Let's take control. So the issue is, back then, talking to these things, it was distinct. Like, you'd have a radio, like an actual major hardware radio thing that was designed to send and to decode the particular signals needed for this particular satellite, because that's how things were done. Make sure that nothing's talking to it that's not supposed to, and what have you. So that doesn't exist anymore, and it would cost millions to recreate. But we've come a long way in radio encryption and decryption. In fact, there's something called, I think it was going to have a link to it. GNU Radio, that's it. Ah, luckily I do have a hooray for our show notes. So GNU Radio lets you make radio packet decoders and encoders just in software. You put in, here's how that radio should work, and your computer becomes one of them. This is okay, I can do that. It's 1950s, 60s, 80s tech. How hard can it be? And so now, instead of using multi-million-dollar massive computers to talk to it, they're basically doing it from an antenna and a laptop, and they're going to adjust its telemetry, and it's going to be swinging by into the moon's shadow around August, and that's the last moment of real fear. It's going to come within about 50 kilometers of the moon. I'm like, why are we buzzing the moon? But okay.
50?
Yes. Like, and they're hoping. Right now, it's still a bit of a guess of where it is, but so it's roughly here. We sent out, how you doing? And it came back, I'm doing good, and I'm coming in. But we're not quite sure where it is. It's all very exciting, and it's a neat... I think people are interested in old tech, old computers, will probably find this story interesting, because this is an example of trying to talk to an old computer as if it's a computer that can only talk over modems, and you can't get access to the building, you're not even really sure where it is, but you know how it likes to talk, so you just send stuff out over the airwaves and it's coming back. And so we're trying as humans to speak to this old computer again, to wake it up, to say, hey, we want to send you back around the sun again, or to do something else, or let's talk to me. How far are you going to hit the moon or not? And so they're trying to wake it up. It's an interesting story about how to go back and speak to a computer in its original code, how to speak to something when the original tech is not there anymore. Hey, let's use software to emulate it. So there's a lot of interesting things here being played out large that are very similar to what we often have to do when you pick up a retro computer and say, okay, well, how do I talk to this thing? I don't have any software, or I don't have the floppy disks. What can I do to interact with this old technology? But in this case, you're interacting with it over thousands of kilometers. It's going to enter the moon's shadow in August. All the batteries are dead, so the last worry is, will it boot back up again when it once again gets sunshine?
So it has some solar batteries.
Yes, exactly. That's why it's going to work essentially forever, because it can power itself off the sun. But okay, it had batteries as well. Those are long dead.
Right.
So once it goes, once we send it behind the moon, or goes behind the moon, it will shut down. It's supposed to then, when it gets power again, boot itself back up. But it's been 36 years. Can it still do that? Who knows? So that's the state it's in at the moment. It's a really interesting retro computer hobby thing being played out right now in space. So I thought people may be interested. Well, I'll have links in the show notes.
That's cool. Okay. Yeah. Very
stakes
good.
Stakes are much higher there than when you're just trying to turn on your old 5150 totally. Or whatever.
It's too bad Earl's not on this show because he's really into radio stuff, and he probably knows about GNU Radio and could speak to it intelligently. I just know it exists.
Right, so. Right. That's nice.
Yeah.
I'm sure he's yelling at his podcast machine right
See,
now.
It's wrong. It's all wrong. And he's yelling at me in Japanese right now. I can hear you, Earl.
Well, Earl, if we haven't got this right, you can contact us on feedback.
All right, so Paul, you had some item that interested you that you wanted to talk about.
Yeah, I was sort of feeling like it was a bit of a slow news week, so I was kind of just looking around and I came across this thing. So I'm going to talk about an eBay auction that will have ended before the. Before this actually goes out, and it isn't an eBay pick because I'm going to try to bid on it, but it's sort of irrelevant in the sense of something to buy. But I thought it was sort of interesting just as a thing to come across. So there was a listing for something. The title of it says Vintage USI International Monitor EV2131A and Keyboard MTU130. And, you know, that sounds like nothing. I'm not even sure how it managed to pop up in my search. But and so it's, the picture of it is just a little, like, you know, 9-inch monitor and this sort of, like, clunky old-looking keyboard thing. And I was wondering, you know, what is this thing? And it, I don't know what even made me look, but it turns out that this is, it's another of the family of 6502 computers from the 70s, or actually I think this was 1981 or something. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't one that I've ever heard of. You know, I've heard of a lot of the, you know, there's the Challenger, and there's various other things that aren't Apples and aren't Commodores and, you know, aren't PETs and things. But this one was completely new to me, and I thought it would be sort of interesting to play around with it. It's I found very little about it. The computer itself is actually called MTE-130. That's one other thing that's kind of interesting about this is that the person who's listing it has no idea what they have. They seem to think that it was more interesting, the monitor was more interesting than this keyboard thing. So it took a little bit of digging to even figure out what it was that I was looking at. But Microtechnology Unlimited of North Carolina introduced the 6502 microcomputer, the MTU-130. And I found there's something in Compute about it, and there's a couple page thing that talks about how the memory is mapped and how it has, you know, very sort of high end graphics and sound. It's supposed to be kind of like a digital audio machine. 1 megahertz 6502. So I thought, if I can get it, we'll see. We'll know next time whether I have it or not. This would be the sort of thing that would be kind of interesting to just play around with. There's going to be no information out there. And, I mean, the thing came with a disk drive originally, and so I'm really not sure if I had it in my hands what I could do with it exactly. But at least it's a 6502, so I can kind of speak its language a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
So,
I think it's really. I'd never heard this before, and so I was reading the Compute article that you pointed us to back from issue 19, and you're right, it's from 1981. And well, you know, having a 1 megahertz 6502, that's cool. Comes with I think you could get it to up to 2 megs of RAM or something ridiculous. It says, yeah, you know, with the two double disk drives and 2 million bytes. So I'm like, it comes with 2 megs. That's an insane amount of RAM. But I was impressed that it does graphics at 480 by 256. I mean, that's when it's in black and white mode. But still, that's really high res for a 1981 home computer.
Yes.
And it can also do 4 levels of grayscale if you step it down to 240 by 256. Also, a very respectable thing because 80 columns built in. It's a remarkable piece of kit, I think. And I'm not surprised because I think it sold for $5,000 or something, so it wasn't cheap, but still, cool looking case and really neat specs. So I'd love this to get in the hands of you or somebody who knows what it is or will sort of rescue it.
So we don't know if this actually, if the company survived, if it sold many of these. We don't have much information about that.
Never even heard of it before.
The company does appear still to be there insofar as they do have a website that has a little timeline.
You think it's under warranty still?
It goes all the way back to 1981. So, and I don't know what do they do now? MTU.com. Not sure. It's a karaoke stuff. It looks like.
Awesome.
But
maybe somebody there can get you a copy. Like, this came with its own version of BASIC and its own version of DOS. So maybe somebody there at least has access to archives or something. It could end up being a real steal because there's 3.5 hours left to go, and it's currently only been bid up to $15.49, plus insane international shipping. So Michael and I
dropped,
are left out.
Yeah, I've dropped out of this one. I was very interested when you put the link in there, but I suddenly became somewhat less interested when it was $675 shipping.
Wow. For me, it's actually just sort of across the state line, so the shipping's not bad to me. At any rate,
but yeah, definitely, if you go for it and you get it, definitely do pop off an email to the company. I think they'd be interested just to sort of know that something from back then, from the original company, is out there. Someone's interested. You never know. You mm-hmm. might get some info off them, and of course. You'll become the renowned world expert on this, and we'll be expecting a new series of podcasts.
Exactly.
The MTU 130 podcast. A huge listenership.
Yeah, USI and me.
I was interested to see from that article in Compute that they were planning on translator utilities for PET Basic and Apple Basic to get programs from those systems to work on this. Which just having something that would do a translation automatically of a program like that sounds like a fascinating exercise.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see what happens. I think at the moment it doesn't look like there's much competition, and of course, as I say, that no one who we're recording this for will have heard this in time to jump in on it. But if it turns out that someone saw it independently and is both beat me at it and then is listening to this. Write in and tell us about it, because we'll be interested to hear about it, even if a little bitter.
Definitely. All right, we have an item here from Michael about a bird.
Yes, I feel that this article is somewhat it's interesting anyway, but definitely not up there on the same level as yours, Paul. But Flappy Bird was pulled from iOS. It was recreated for the C64 system. And now, all those Apple II users out there, you too can have your Flappy Bird. So follow the link, and it's Flapple Bird.
Flapple Bird, yes.
Yep. But what I found most interesting about it is that the graphics have been done in a mode of the low-res graphics of the Apple.
Double
low res. So
which we don't have hardly anything was ever done to use double low res.
No, definitely not. So it's basically, for those who aren't familiar, low res, you might understand. Was that the 16 color?
Yes, that was the 16 color.
And very very chunky graphics, very easy to use. And the double one is literally that, so double in the horizontal. And it really makes the game is perfect, and I just the artwork, it's very very. I hadn't seen colorization done quite like this for any Apple games in the past, so it looks real good, and this might actually end up being the first instance of Flappy Bird that I'll be downloading and playing.
I like how they don't call it a remake; it's called a demake. It's a demake of Flappy Bird. I thought that was excellent.
Well, and I tried this. I didn't try getting it onto a disc to actually use on my Apple IIe. I did it on my two emulators, Virtual 2 and Sweet 16. On Virtual 2, for some reason, it didn't seem to recognize that there was the availability of double low-res graphics. I'm not sure maybe if that didn't get programmed into that emulator properly, but it didn't show up the way it should. On Sweet 16, I was able to get it to play, although it was a little flaky. The bird would disappear sometimes while you're playing it, but at least I saw the proper colors. The video that he shows on YouTube, though, on this, you look at this and say, this is an Apple II game? The colors and the graphics just... you're right, I just never saw anything like that on an Apple II before.
But the good thing is that you don't need an Apple II to play. Go over to the webpage. Not only can you download it in a 5.25 or a 3.5 inch disk image, there's also a link to play it online with a online virtual Apple emulator.
Now, I didn't try that.
We've talked about this in the past, that these online emulators are great. They allow you to put a link and a usable reference to retro games and software so that you can actually pass the connection on to people. They can experience it. They can use it online. They don't need to go through all the hassles of setting up an emulator. They might not have the hardware to run it. So all you non-Apple guys out there, click on the link and go and have your little dose of Retro Flappy.
I was going to say that it's interesting that there weren't more things using that particular mode, because that particular mode of graphics on this computer would have been quite quick. I mean, it's a very just in terms of how the technical aspects of the machine work, it's a fast thing to do. It's much quicker than trying to blit pixels into a high res screen.
Definitely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, double O's res is essentially just 80 columns, but with graphics. And it's a good use of color, because I was looking at this going, are there that many greens? So I just looked it up, and yeah, there was the dark green, light green, and aqua. And I guess there are 3 greens available for the low res. Really smart use of color.
Yeah, so he's also got on his website, Dagan Brock has a GitHub link, and he talks a lot about the development of it on that particular page. So for those who are interested in how you take something and use it like this, there's a lot of information here for programmers and non-programmers.
Nice.
All right. I had found in some of the, and I apologize to the audience, this is like more Apple II stuff, but I found a link today in the news this week that is for a compiler that has been made that works on, does assembly language that will run for the Apple I, the Apple II, or the Apple III. And this is the Plasma is what it's called. And this was done by, I got to look back at my notes, remember who here.
It's David Schmink.
Yeah, David Schmink. The proto language assembler for the Apple is what he calls it. And he's got an Apple I version 2 and an Apple III version. I thought that's pretty darn cool that you can make this to work with those three very different architectures, but all using the same CPU, of course. But having a tool like that for the Apple I, something that they never, of course, in the day had, it's just pretty neat that they could make it like that. And if you wanted to back cross-compile something for that computer, you could do it easily with this tool. And so we have a link in the show notes about it. I thought it's just a neat item.
It definitely seems interesting to me, although I have a feeling that I don't quite understand it. But like I'm not exactly sure what I would use. I'm not sure what I would write using this, you know, with these three computers as targets.
Well, one of my limitations on the Apple I to begin with, although it's really cool and it's very historical, it's like I'm not really sure what I would do with an Apple I, because it's just basically a terminal with a microprocessor in it, and you can do some programming. And there's probably much more that I give it credit for, but I can't think of anything I would do with it. But if I wanted to do something with it, here's a tool.
Exactly. Maybe the first thing we could write a backspace.
There we go. It would be very useful on that computer, yes. All right. Paul, did you have something else? Some spare news here?
Oh yes, that's true. I think we have mentioned this maybe multiple times across the run of this podcast, but I just came across the, it's a 1980-something, I think, documentary called Hackers, Wizards of the Electronic Age. And it's you can buy it, I came across it through a link on YouTube, but it's very interesting to watch. It's got a young Steve Wozniak and Bill Budge and, you know, people sort of talking about, it's not all Apple, but, you know, sort of talking about the idea of hackers and, you know, innovation and that sort of thing. Definitely worth watching. I don't have much more to say about it exactly now, but just, you know, something. If you haven't come across it, I would recommend it.
I have that movie or that on a VHS tape somewhere. Then I have reviewed it once in the last few years, and it's interesting. It's historical, but it's interesting to watch it. So I would definitely recommend that. Oh, shall we talk about upcoming retro computer events? Who put this in about Switzerland?
I think it's just an event that's coming up.
Yep. Yeah. Fess up.
Okay.
No, it's not one that I'm going to, but it was basically just brought to our attention by one of our listeners. And as we've always said, if you've got an event coming up and you'd just like a bit of a shout-out about it, drop us a line. Details on the webpage. But, yep, this one is in a fortnight's time. So.
And this is like a Commodore 8-bit repair.
Yep, it's an in-depth how-to. I'm sorry, but I won't be able to drop in. I won't be in Europe next fortnight. But
we'll send Earl. No.
Well, he's out and about. He can drop in on his way home.
Definitely.
So yeah, just as I said, there's lots of activities happening out there. So if you are aware of something that's happening in your neck of the woods, let us know, and we'll make sure that other people find out about it.
We'll crash your party.
We'll crash your party, yes.
Indeed. All right, another one coming up, of course, next month in July is Kansas Fest 2014, going from July 22nd to the 27th in Kansas City, and the early registration for that is ending June. Well, ended.
I think it's ended. Sorry. Yep.
Yeah, ended June 1st, so we're reporting on old stuff again.
well, that's the point of the podcast, right?
That's right. they do have on the KansasFest.org website a list of some of the things that are planned for topics. Looks like a very interesting set of sessions, and if you feel like you have some hand-eye coordination abilities and you want to stitch an Apple IIe Christmas ornament, you can do that. They're like a hand-stitched thing they're going to have something there for, but there's
that
a lot
really
of other
fun
stuff,
I signed
too
up for that. That looks really fun.
Yeah, just kind of a cool cool little item there. And I think we're going to have some hardware thing you can do also, but I don't recall if I've got if I can see that on the list. But there's a lot of cool things going to be coming. So even though you missed the early registration, if you realize I should do this, recognize that you can get the info at the Kansas Fest website.
It'll be awesome. I can't wait. Love it, love it, love it. I'll be doing a session this year. I'm really excited about that. I'm excited about going. I think I'm going. I haven't got my confirmation yet, but I'm still sort of waiting on that, but I'm assuming I am going.
And I believe everyone else has got their confirmation.
It's that shipping from Canada, I think.
So I will be near Kansas Fest and also hopefully at Kansas Fest. If not, please look outside the windows. I will be on the street with a disappointed look holding my session out there on the sidewalk.
All right, that'll be worth the video right there.
In the rain. Yeah, I can't wait. Best retro event of the year. I look forward to it months in advance. Can't wait to go.
And then at the Living Computer Museum, what's this happening in August?
Vintage Computer Fair, I think.
Okay.
I'm just reading the title.
Okay.
The details have just gone into their latest newsletter. There's always something happening at the Living Computer Museum. So it's come and meet Unisys V380 and leave with a personalized license. So basically, you get to get up close and personal to a mainframe and leave with a little bit of a souvenir.
And cool. Where is that at? What's the location?
Well, to me, it's just somewhere over there in the U.S. it's a little island off the coast of Europe. halfway between Europe and Asia, isn't it?
I think that's right.
it's in Seattle. Yeah. It's that one.
Gotcha. Okay.
So I think Earl is planning to go to this, so we should hear some kind of report.
I think Earl was sentenced to it by the court. It's one of the things he's going to be doing some computing and cleaning up garbage.
I think
he's probably going to be the sysop for it as well.
Earl knows what he did.
The very first computers seemed as big as houses and so mysterious that for most of us, the computer was behind a closed door. But IBM was thinking how to make the computer more useful. And as one good idea led to another, it began getting smaller, faster, less expensive, and easier to use. Today, a new IBM computer has reached a personal scale. A person can afford it. A person can put it anywhere. Office, home, or school. And a person can learn to use it with ease. IBM made its personal computer to help a person be more productive, to help a person be more creative. And those are good reasons for a person to feel good. The IBM personal computer, coming to selected stores across the country.
All right, so now we get to the part of the show where we have the host retro computing gift idea. And I found this, and I looked at this, and I blinked my eye a second time, and I looked again, and this is a really cool item somebody's come up with. USBtypewriter.com not only lets you use an old keyboard on your modern computer, but it uses, like, I don't even know for sure how this works. It uses pretty much any kind of old keyboard. You can have a manual typewriter with the keys that flop up and hit the roller for your typewriter, and it will translate it into text that will work through a USB on your modern computer.
Mm-hmm.
I think that is pretty darn amazing.
I have built one of these myself ages ago. I've been meaning to put a video up for
Does it
ages.
Work for you?
Yeah, it works perfectly. In fact, maybe I never thought about it. I'll bring it down to Kansas Fest.
It's actually
pretty simple to make one of these. The first one I made was from scratch, and I have another one where I got a kit. There's a few, you know, convert it yourself over kits where you get a little board, and basically it's just as you hook them up to the different keys, and you say, hook this one up to your A, hook this one up to your B, and basically it's using essentially like a little Arduino or a Teensy or something like that to say as you bring in this thing, as you short, just like a normal keyboard works, where you set up a little matrix, and when it shorts certain combinations, you say when this dot is shorted, it's shorting lines 16 and 8. When those ones go together, call that a lowercase e or what have you. So it's pretty cool. And they're actually really simple. The key is you can really only convert manual typewriters. I tried to do it on electric, but a lot of times they're not using the same little arm. You need an arm that's going to move. So as long as you have like it can't work off a ball typewriter. It'll never be able to work off like
a Selectric.
A Selectric, yeah, or one of those wheels, like a daisy wheel. It's got to be the old-fashioned, you know, the ones that can come up and jam, like a jammable keyboard is what you need. And they're actually really simple. So I think there's a few kits. I'll find the one that I used the second time I converted it, and it was like $80 or something like that. And, oh, yeah, here it is, USBtypewriter.com. Okay. I think you're linking to the actual one that I bought.
So, yeah, that just looked pretty cool. I thought that's what you can get me when you're looking for my gift idea, so. All right.
The video too. If you have a chance to watch it, there's a relatively short 5-minute video or something that kind of gives you an overview, and it's actually pretty funny as you sort of get it. Sort of, you know, among the features, it continues to list things like, you know, you can even like turn off the computer and just, you know, type. whatever. It's worth watching even if you're not going to build one.
I'm still trying to get my. I have a typewriter that I'm trying to go the other way with. Smith Corona, for a very short period in the 80s, made a series of typewriters called the Messenger typewriters. They were a typewriter that had a parallel port interface built in. They're an electric typewriter. And separate from that, you could buy the Messenger box, which I have one, and that took forever to track down. So I have a Messenger box, I have a Smith Corona Messenger typewriter. As far as I can tell, I've got them typing to each other, and I can occasionally get that to then continue along the line into a computer. So you can use a Smith Corona typewriter with your Apple II, and it just comes in and it says, okay, I'm sending my keys to the Apple II. But what's more fun is you can go the other way as well. So you can have an electric typewriter that acts as a parallel printer from a vintage computer. That's sort of how it was designed to work. I kind of have it working and kind of don't. It might be another thing I bring down to Kansas Fest and show off. Here's a 50% working one. Who wants to dive in and finish the rest of it? Because it's really obscure. There's like no freaking info. A lot of typewriters that claim to be Messenger typewriters are not. So it was quite the chore to actually get one of those too. So I have all the pieces now, I think, and I've made the cable that's needed, I think, and it's kind of working. So that's another thing. If you're interested in typewriters connecting to computers, that the Smith Corona Messenger series was sort of the old way to do that in the 80s.
Okay. Nice.
So if a character is sent to the typewriter, does the key depress like a player piano?
Well, it does because it's an electric typewriter. The key doesn't depress. The actual typewriting arm does go and hit it. So it's like somebody's typing. It gives you a ghost typewriter. That's kind of what I wanted. I thought it was neat to be able to have a typewriter type on its own.
All right.
It's been a lot of work.
Yeah, I know people out there like their mechanical clacky keyboards, but I think if I had one of these USB typewriter keyboards in front of my three monitors at work, people would really think that Michael's gone round the bend and he ain't coming back. Anyway, most of my stuff's done in a Telnet session anyway, so a typewriter keyboard is just what I'd be looking for.
That's what you need. All right, well, thinking of other things that we can get, we have some eBay auctions that people have come up with. Would you like to go first, Carrington?
Yes, other than I would like no one to bid on this, because I so desperately love it, and I don't know if it'll be the only one they make. So this is Digi4D, which is a company kind of known, I think, for making cables. So if you want to get, I think we've maybe talked about it before, but they sell a lot of stuff online, or he, I don't know if it's one or two people or a bunch of people or what have you, but they frequently sell Amiga and Apple II things online, and it's a source for new, old cables. If you're looking for a serial cable or a parallel cable or just an adapter or what have you, they sell newly created bagged versions of those on eBay and have done so for a while, and also have two versions of a floppy adapter. This is the company that made the HDDD, I think that's how it went, 3Ds, which lets you set a 3.5-inch floppies connected to retro computers. Anyway, this is an HDMI / VGA video adapter for any Apple II. The Apple II, 2+, 2E, 2C, 2C+. So it takes the composite video from the computer and does the proper conversion so it spits HDMI out the other end, which is something you can do with other adapters, so it's difficult to find ones that work well, and the images here seem to imply that it works quite well. But I love that it's been put in a case that looks right out of an Apple II line. Like, this looks like something that would have shipped with an Apple II.
Definitely.
Yeah, and I adore it. It's currently been bid up to €2.5. But unfortunately, it has 8 days left to go, and I think it's going to go for like $300, and I want it so badly, and I don't think I'm going to bid on it. So this is my choice, and I think it is a gorgeous piece of kit, and it would look perfect beside an Apple II.
Well, Carrington, I won't be bidding on this one, and it's not because of the shipping. There's a little note in there that says, this device is designed for Apple II Computers USA version, does not work with the European versions of the Apple II Plus, 2E, and 2C. So they've just gone and eliminated all of my toys from using this.
Yeah, and the company Digi4D, who I think I'm pretty sure I bought from before, is based in Bulgaria. So you'd think it wouldn't be an NTSC thing, but it is. It's designed for me. Please, no one else bid. I want it so badly.
This is strange that it would be coming from there and would not have any ability to run PAL.
Well, I am kind of hoping that this is just the first of a bunch. It looks like it was really well put together. Maybe this is being put out as a test balloon to see, well, what will this go for? And then they'll offer a bunch. I might contact them directly saying, will you please just sell me one? I would like to just pay you and buy one.
That is a cool item.
I think this is a route that they often use just to, you know, as a storefront.
Isn't it gorgeous, though? It's so pretty. It's just exactly what I would want in an HDMI adapter for an Apple II. The industrial design looks perfect beside a 2C or a 2E. Oh, I want it really badly.
Great.
Anyway, that's what I want. €2.5. I think it will go for far more.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Paul, what did you have then?
Well, I was kind of scrambling here at the last minute. For some reason, my normal eBay radar isn't working or something, but I think this was kind of an interesting thing. I had it on my own watch list for a while, although ultimately, well, what it is, it's the Prodigy Interactive Personal Service Startup Kit, I'm sort of familiar with this box. I didn't actually use Prodigy myself, but I remember seeing this box around. It's a big yellow box. This particular one is still shrink wrapped. It's for the you know, IBM PC family. I guess all the way up to AT existed at this point. And it's an online service. It's like CompuServe or, it's a competitor to those.
Yeah, or Genie. Right,
exactly. And I forget, what are the others? The Source?
Well, it looks more impressive than the AOL Coaster CDs.
Yes.
Yeah, I think it was, it was a serious player for a while. This is, of course, completely useless as a functional thing now. But it's still shrink wrapped, so you can open it and read the manuals and install the software and pretend, go ooh, or whatever, make little modem sounds.
Well, and I will say, as somebody who was trying to write about, not Prodigy, because really there was no Apple II connection with Prodigy, but was trying to write some interesting or useful things about the early services, the Source and Genie and CompuServe, when I was getting my book put together, is that sometimes trying to find the original, package photos or information that was shipped with these things is really hard to do. You have to really dig to find some of this stuff, and if somebody wanted to use this for research basis, to just run it on one of their old computers to see what it looked like, at least without actually connecting, or see what the manual looks like. Scan that and get it on archive.org. I mean, that's the kind of thing. That's the kind of source that you'd have for this information as somebody who happens to still have one sitting around, unopened or unopened.
I like looking at the list of things you can do on the back, and a lot of them are, the normal stuff: book an airline reservation, get advice from nationally known experts. I like that it says you can order groceries delivered to your home in some areas. Well, that's still coming for most of us.
That's right.
And of course, you can get stock quotes and you can buy and sell stocks from a discount broker. It is remarkable. As somebody who has never really had any interest whatsoever in buying any stocks ever, it is crazy how many sources and how many companies over my computing lifetime have given me ways to buy stock. Have it like every phone, every online service, every everything. Everyone seems to think I would be really interested in doing this, and I have never taken any of them ever up on the offer. So Prodigy, too late.
I just wonder, was it something that would be easier to do in that day with Prodigy than it would be the way that one ordinarily purchased stocks? I
want a ticker tape like from the 1940s, or I'm not interested.
That would be good. Yeah. Get yourself a ticker tape connection that would interface with your old retro computer.
I have been trying to source a ticker tape type printer forever. I have worked out software that will spit out both in serial and parallel and over USB my Twitter stream as a single line of characters. And I want that in ticker tape, and I can't find a ticker tape machine that isn't like $2,000. They go for insane money. And even then, I don't know how I'll interface it, but the first step is to get one. So I might have to build one from scratch. Maybe a maker thing or something. So
there we go.
Want one so badly. I just want to come home and see how my Twitters are doing today. Oh my goodness, cats are up.
I bet they are. All right, and then Michael has something.
Yeah, so Acorn Archimedes 3000. So for you guys in North America, this is something from the other side of the ditch. It's the shots of it are actually quite good, and at the moment it's only 1250 pounds. So not too bad at the moment. But again, it's one of these items, 6 days to go, and I expect that this one will definitely go for a lot more. It's really just a computer which I was aware of, but it's one that I've never got to play with. And shipping for this one is only £29, so that's not too bad. That comes out to just over $50 Australian.
So is it a PC clone or what?
No, it's part of the BBC home computers. Mm-hmm. So it's, as I said, it's not something I've had much to do with, but
the Archimedes, this one, this is before the Electron and stuff, right? This is like their earliest one, isn't it? I can't remember which order things come in, but I'm pretty sure it's particularly early.
Although I think it's still after the BBC Micro.
Yeah, the BBC Micro is the beginning of all them, but I think like there's the Acorn Electron. I don't know. I'm so out of the loop when it comes to that whole line. Somebody is listening right now just shaking their head. Ah, you Canadian.
At least one of these versions came out in the late 1980s. So it looks like 87 is when the 300, 400 series were shipped. And the other one might have been 89. This might be a 1989 version.
Okay, so then the Acorn Electron's 83, so the Electron was first. I guess you could tell from the industrial design this looks older as well. So.
And it's some sort of a RISC chip that is running off of, doesn't specify, it's an ARM architecture, but it doesn't specify any particular vendor. So, okay, cool. All right, well, I don't have any eBay item this week. I looked and I couldn't find anything that really sounded too interesting, so I thought I'd leave it for the rest of you detectives to identify a good item to look for on eBay. So, closing discussions. Who wants to talk about what's coming up in the next week or so?
Well, I'm gonna put it out there. 2014 Retro Challenge is hopefully coming up this July, so I'm going to dust off my project that I tried for the winter warm-up previously. So we'll see if we can actually get a little bit further. My project was basically to take from the Nibble computer magazine, there was a Nibble programmer, which basically allowed you to write basic programs in a full screen text editor, no line numbers, additional functions that were in there, and I created some myself, and I'm going to rewrite my SBASIC interpreter in SBASIC, so get it to compile itself.
Nice.
All right. And anybody else? Carrington, you got something?
Sure. Over on Reddit, somebody recently posted a link to this, which reminded me that it exists over on archive.org. There's the Computer Magazine Archives. So if you're interested in, hey, I want to get a copy, who scanned what's available, there is one handy page over at archive.org that links to, like, as a catalog, here are all the magazines that we know about and we have scans of. So it's a nice place to sort of bookmark, and I forgot about it. So I only discovered it again today, so now I've bookmarked it, so I'm going to make sure we put a link in the show notes. So if you're ever trying to think, like, how would I find myself a copy of, you know, the MSX Amiga magazine for Brazil or Analog Computing or what have you, like, something, does something exist, like K-Pro magazine? I didn't even know there was a K-Pro magazine. That sort of thing. There's one site you can go to, and here's everything that archive.org has, magazine-wise. So it's a nice, handy page, I think. So make sure I have that in the show notes.
Yeah, it's a good link back to our topic where we're talking about how do you get started in retro computing. So these magazines, they're have either magazines solely devoted to, or other magazines have articles on beginners in a particular computer. So if you're into BBC Micros or Commodores, you'll be able to find magazines with articles on how to get started, how to create your disks, how to use the disk operating systems, how to do the graphics, what you can do with it, ideas of the games and other software that's available.
And the ads are fun to read.
And I love the ads. The ads yes. are killers.
Ads are the best part.
That is the yep. best part. I find some of those things to be hysterical to look at.
And also, I'll read about things where I go, did that exist? Could I find that now? Sometimes I'll look at something and go, did it actually come out? Because that looks amazing. And then I go on a hunt to try to track it down. So.
And that was really definitely fun. A great resource for research. You know, if you want to do something historical and you need to research it, there's where you find it exactly when did something come out and what were they saying about it. And, oh, this thing got advertised and this never appeared and mm-hmm. so on. So
yeah, interesting. Yeah, I had not seen this archive.org page, organized this in this way before. But, yeah, that is nice. I should say that I can see a couple that I know are out there that aren't listed here.
There are many that aren't, and it's like I went and looked at some magazine that was like Micro Adventure magazine or something. I said, oh, that sounds fun, and they have issues like 13 through 17. I'm like, oh, so there's a lot of scanning that still needs to be done. So if you're on there and you happen to have a magazine that's not on archive.org, you know, maybe get some scanning done or hit up the crew over there and say, I've got something you don't have. Would you like it? Because they would like it.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it would be very helpful to have a good central. I have a bunch of things, actually. I should send them.
Well, they do that. And they've got, of course, they have the high-speed scanners and can do a really good job with getting the scans that will work at all kinds of resolutions for people then. So, Paul, you got something coming up?
Well, I was going to say I have many sort of like open little bits here. I was going to add to the K-Pro magazine one. I have few issues of that, and if you look at, I think it's this number two, volume one, number two, has a very nice cover with the cover is somebody roller skating with a K-Pro you know, to sort of demonstrate the nice, right, exactly, the portability of it. A while back I got I don't know how long ago this was, but I got one of the Osborne ones, you know, the with a little tiny screen, and it seems to pretty much work. It's missing the space bar, but otherwise it's in fairly good shape. And I got a little bit, for some reason I just kind of fell down a little bit of a rabbit hole there trying to figure out, you know, like what was going on with Osborne and, you know, like how the company worked. And so along the way I got a bunch of issues of Foghorn, which is the first Osborne group newsletter. So I've been sort of scanning those and reading those, and it's been interesting because Osborne, I'm not sure if this is familiar territory, probably is, but Osborne, there's a famous story about what happened with them, which is that they had the Osborne 1, the OCC 1, and then they announced too early the fact that the executive, the OCC 2, I think, was going to be released, and so everybody canceled their Osborne 1 orders, and the company went bankrupt.
Yes.
People do say sometimes that that's not exactly the entire issue. I read something about how it was somebody found a whole bunch of, you know, someone who was in charge found a whole bunch of kind of like motherboards that were left over and decided they wanted to build them all into, you know, Osborne 1 machines, which no longer were selling, and they went into a hole and whatever. But the thing is, Osborne did go bankrupt. And then a little bit later, you know, they got back on their feet and released a third one, which was, I think, the OCC 4, the Vixen. But at any rate, reading the Foghorn thing was sort of interesting because you can sort of see them trying to cope, you know, with the fact that, you know, that, you know, they've just reached their third year and Osborne has gone bankrupt.
Dear.
And I guess so. The other thing too is the retro computing, the retro challenge is something that I would like to try as well. But I looked on the website and see no indication of you know, what's happening this summer. But I'm assuming that it will happen.
Oh, there was a tweet that came out earlier in the week, so they're actually getting around to doing it. So it's normally July, so they've got just under a month to get the new blog entry up and to be accepting competition suggestions. So probably have a live link to that in our next podcast.
Yeah, I find not that there's a good time, but July is always very rough because Kansas Fest takes over sort of the second half, so there's only the first half of July available.
Oh, you'll just have to work twice as hard then. But our Earl got an honourable mention in the winter warm-up, so he actually got one of his projects finished after threatening to do it for so many sessions. But I'm taking that as inspiration that I should be able to get mine done, hopefully.
All right. I hope you do.
I'll just add a few extra caveats in there just in case it doesn't happen.
All right. Well, I just have for myself, I'm 6 months into having the book out, and I kept thinking I need to get something on my webpage that has additions or corrections, and I've got a couple corrections I need to make. So I've got to start getting on that information, compiling it, and placing it in a place where I can keep honest and let people know that the book isn't the last bit. Here's some changes. And I think that's it for the show this week. You can find show notes for all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss in the forums at vintagecomputer.com/vcforum. You can follow RCR on Twitter at rcrpodcast. You can send feedback to feedback@rcrpodcast.com. We are a member of the Throwback Network. And please write a review on iTunes and tell people how wonderful you think this is. And until next time,
Retro Compute!
Echo, echo, echo.